and the crowd loud. Fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want. We want, we want, we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips. Joining me today as co-host is the Project Censored Professor Nolan Higdon. He teaches Latin American history at the California State University East Bay. Mickey Huff will return next week. On today's show, we interview Miguel Farga, First Secretary of the Cuban Embassy in Washington, D.C., who will discuss the emerging issues of reestablishing diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Cuba. Also, we're going to ask him what it was like to grow up in a communist country. We hope you stay tuned.
Without oppressive forces, slaving for almighty dollar bills, we won. We got the love of just our brothers and our sisters. We won. People together can overthrow the system. We won. We got that love of just your brothers and your sisters. We won. People together can overthrow the system. We got the love of.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips. My co-host today, Nolan Higdon, teaches Latin American history at California State University, East Bay. Mickey will be back next week. On today's show, we're going to interview Miguel Farga, First Secretary of the Cuban Embassy. Here's Nolan to introduce him.
Miguel Farga is the First Secretary of the U.S. Embassy of Cuba. For the previous 4 years, he's worked in the office of the United States Division of Cuban Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Havana, Cuba. Before that, he served as Third Secretary in the Cuban Embassy in Canada. Farga received a Bachelor of Science in Law at the University of Havana and a Master of Science in Foreign Relations from Higher Institute of Foreign Relations, Rauro Garcia, in Havana. Farga has been speaking in the San Francisco Bay Area addressing the question, has U.S. policy towards Cuba really changed? Welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the opportunity.
We love having you. What can you tell us about what it was like to grow up in Cuba?
That is a very interesting question. I was born in 1979, so 37 years ago. And, you know, this is interesting for me because the society that I know is a society with equal opportunities for everybody. That is the first thing that you learn in Cuba, okay? It's not a matter of gender, it's not a matter of race, it's not a matter of wealthy, you know, it's only equal opportunities for everybody. So as a child, you go to the school that is in your neighborhood, you go to the hospital that you have in your neighborhood, you have equal opportunities. It's about social justice, you know. Kids in Cuba don't know what is poverty, what is not to have the opportunity to study, they don't have to work, they only have to go to school. This is what we have. So for us, it's rights. It's our right to go to the school, it's our right to go to have a good healthcare system. So that is how we grew up, you know. We don't have enough resources in Cuba to have all these things that rich countries have. But, for example, my first time with internet was in the university. I was studying law at the time in the Havana University, and we were almost 1,000 students. And we have this, I believe, 30 computers with internet for 1,000 students. Imagine how difficult that was. But everybody had the opportunity to go and see what internet is, you know, for free. And some of us don't use the computer to do research, only to know more about the world. And this is very interesting because I had the opportunity to travel here in the United States. I was in Alabama, I was in Michigan, also in Connecticut, Washington State, and now here in California. And everybody's asked to me, okay, are you ready for this new moment with the United States? And I say, are you going to change your culture? And I say, well, you know, we know all your movies, we see your TV series, we share a lot of our culture, and we don't change. And by the way, some people believe that now is a new moment, but we have relations with all the countries in the world. Right now, we reestablish the relation with the United States, but it's nothing, you know, because sometimes, and I believe this is very important, and for that reason I am here, there is not enough information about Cuba. People don't know what is the real Cuba because you are not able to travel to Cuba. Because remember, as American, you can go wherever you want. But in order to go to Cuba, you need a license. So we don't have enough Americans traveling to Cuba. And here, unfortunately, there is a lot of misinformation. But probably you know more about misinformation here than myself.
That's an interesting point you bring up there, because the narrative that we almost use a lot here in the United States is that we stopped holding normalized relations, as it were, in the 1960s. But before then, there was like this happy relationship and Cuba and the U.S. got along. But I wanted to sort of point to that because The U.S. always has been intervening in Cuban affairs, both before and after normalized relations. And knowing that history, how do the Cuban people feel about this? Do they actually see this as a change or another step in a long process of this, what can only be described as a difficult relationship with the United States?
Well, I think this is a wonderful question. And I always say to people that ask me about that, you know what? If you go to Cuba right now, you're going to see that despite all the 50 years of embargo, all these 50 years of difference between Cuba and United States, Cubans don't hate Americans. If you go there, you're welcome. Everybody's going to say, oh, wonderful, you're from the United States? Where part are you from? People probably want to know about how is your baseball, Major League baseball, what is happening with the Cuban players here. People want to know about your culture. And you're going to see that. There is not hate in Cuba because we know that one thing is the U.S. government and another thing is the American people. You know, we share a lot of sins between Cuba and the United States. And this is very interesting because some people believe that Cubans comes to the United States after 1959. And no. The tobacco factories were in Tampa since the 19th century. And our national hero comes to the United States, Jose Martí, comes to the United States in the 19th century to start the independence war against Spain. So there is a lot of history between our two countries. And again, this is what we are trying to talk with the people, we are trying to explain to people.
So you grew up in a society of general equality, mm-hmm. and you weren't blasted with advertisements of buying things. This is one of the things that was most interesting to me when I was in Cuba the last two times, was with the young people, I could kid with them and say, don't you want a Happy Meal? And they would know what I was talking about, but they would just laugh and laugh and laugh about how funny that was, because that's not part of the culture. You're not blasted with these buy this, buy that. Do you see that making changes in that area, or will people, once that's in their personality, will that stay with them?
You know, as I explained before, we are a small country, 11 million of people. We don't have enough resources. So our priorities are education and healthcare. According to the World Bank, in 2010, we spent 12.8% of our GDP in education, only in education. According to the World Bank, at that time, 2010, that was the highest investment in education worldwide. We almost spent more or less the same in health. So we don't have any money for advertising. You know, that is not our priority. You know, people in Cuba knows what they have. And this is important because we don't want to create difference among people. You know, we want to try to have all the people with equal opportunities and in society, that if you have more money, you go to the same store that the people that don't have all the money that you have. So it's the same store. You know, we don't want to create this difference among people because that is not what we want. And for example, right now we are giving more space to the private sector, but that private sector is only on those fields that we believe that is going to help to improve our economy. And we are going to improve that economy to have resources for having a better education system and a better health system, because we don't want to privatize that. We are not going to privatize that. And people in Cuba want more, you know, because we are young. We know what all these good things you have, but we don't want that. Only a few people in Cuba can have that.
So people that come to Cuba or go there for education, go there for medical training, they're not charged.
No, for free.
And so talk about the Cuban input in terms of medical care, not only in Cuba, but worldwide.
Oh, yes, we have right now more than 50,000 doctors working in 68 countries. So we are talking about a lot of doctors, you know, a lot of healthcare workers. And this was very interesting because people don't know that when the Katrina hurricane hit the United States, we offered 1,000 doctors to come here in 2005. Some people say here, that is politics, you know. Unfortunately, after that, we have this earthquake in Pakistan, and we send doctors to Pakistan because Pakistan asks for help. And by the way, it's because we believe in solidarity, you know. We sent 400 doctors to fight the Ebola epidemic in Africa, because the World Health Organization asked for help, and we sent those doctors there. And by the way, for the first time in many years, we worked together with the United States. United States provide the hospitals provide some resources and we provide the doctors. And probably we have the same opportunity right now in Haiti. You are going to provide the facilities, you are going to provide some resources, and we are going to provide the doctors. And this is very interesting. You know, I don't know why it's not in your project sensor, because probably we need to put more information about Cuba, because people don't know. And in the case of Haiti, I remember when the big earthquake, all the media was there. Okay, we are going to be here all the time that it's needed. And they start saying, okay, all the world is helping. All the countries are sending doctors and wherever. And we had a lot of doctors in Haiti before the 10 years before the earthquake. And for that reason, we only need to send, I believe, 40 other doctors, because all the doctors were Cuban and were there working.
The year that happened, it was a project censor.
Thank you very much.
I wonder, you keep mentioning about education and healthcare in Cuba, and I would be interested, so sure our listeners would as well. We've often been raised in the United States with these myths about this horrific education system in Cuba and horrific healthcare in Cuba. And I wonder if you could paint sort of like some picture of what does education look like in Cuba? What does healthcare look like in Cuba? And maybe use what you've seen here in the United States as a way to explain it.
Well, if you allow me, I want to say first that I don't come here to say that we are better than you. That is a very important message that I want to stress here. Because what I am trying to do is to explain that we have a lot of good things in Cuba that probably you don't know here. And we are ready to work with the United States for having more opportunities. And I believe that is good for both people. So I didn't come here to say you have to learn from us. I only came here to say, okay, we are ready to learn from you also. But about education, let me explain that. You know, I had the opportunity to visit a lot of university here. And when you are in the room and you see all the computers, all the TV, all the technology that you have there, you say, okay, I don't have this in Cuba. We still use chalk to write in our boards in Cuba, but nobody there has to pay anything. No for books, no for being here. They graduate and they don't have any debt because they don't have to pay for nothing there. So it's something very humble, very simple, and they have wonderful teachers, you know. And probably they pass the books from one year to another year, and sometimes the books are old and everybody put the hands there, and you know, but the knowledge is there and the teachers are there. And according to what I read, the Cuban professionals are very well respected, and this is because the education that they have, you know, and this is part of the work of the revolution. But when you say revolution, people don't understand what is that. The revolution is what the majority of the Cuban people wants, you know. It's why we changed everything in 1959. And all this process is only because the majority of the people support that, you know. And now that we are doing changes in Cuba in the last year, people want more, but people don't want to lose what they have.
So I certainly observed you speaking at Sonoma State University on Monday night, and the students there were like, oh, well, we should have that here, too. I mean, why do we have to end up with a BA degree and $20,000 in debt? But to hear that, the campuses are no cost, and the food, the books, everything is taken care of at the universities. So talk about how important and how different that is, really, from the rest of the world. I mean, is there anybody that's anywhere near as a society with that kind of educational support?
I think that is very important in order to have a better society, you know. And about the food, about the accommodations, because at the beginning we had a few universities in Cuba, so people have to come, for example, from another province to Havana, and they didn't have to pay for the food, for the accommodations. Right now, what we're trying to do is to expand the universities. So we have universities almost in all our province. You know, all the careers that you can study without a lot of resources, you can have it in your own province. Because some careers are expensive, and you don't have the opportunity probably to put labs, expensive labs, in all places. But if you are studying, for example, law, and you only need a couple of books, a couple of codes, it's easy to send that to all the people, you know? So what we're trying to do is to, and this is very important, you know, in Cuba, you have the opportunity to study. So if you don't go to the university, you are behind the society, you know, and you are encouraged to go to there because everybody has a degree, you know. So it's a very competitive society with a lot of knowledge there, and people have the opportunity to go there because they don't have to pay, you know, they don't have to worry about nothing. It's a normal transit, you know, all the way through the university. The only thing that you need is to be a good student.
When it comes to these different provinces, the way they share these different education, how is that system organized? We have like a Department of Education over here that oversees. How is it organized, the way these different provinces work together to decide which province?
Well, we have a Ministry of Education and also a Ministry of Higher Education for the universities. And they are the authorities in all the country. But they have office in all province, and in the case that you have, for example, universities in some municipal term, that you have an office there that run, and you have a career, the program for your studies are approved in the ministry. And it's the same program for all the country. So the people who study in Havana or in Santiago has the same program, so equal opportunities. You know, you don't need to go to the Havana. Probably Havana University is the very well-known university in Cuba because that was our first university and was founded in 1728. But yes, of course, everybody wants to go there because all the history, you know, but you don't need to go there to have better education because you have the same program, the same curriculum program in Santiago or in Guantanamo.
Okay, I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with Peter Phillips. This is the Project Censored Show. We're talking to Miguel Fraga, the first secretary of the Embassy of Cuba here in the United States, and we will continue our conversation after this short break.
Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips in studio with Nolan Higdon. We're interviewing Miguel Fraga, first secretary of the embassy in Cuba in Washington, D.C., and he's been out visiting the Bay Area, speaking a number of different colleges and that. Oftentimes, when Cuba is talked about in the corporate media, it's described as a communist dictatorship. Could you talk about that a little bit and about democracy and the people's involvement in the government in Cuba?
Oh, yes. I think this is a wonderful opportunity, but probably I need more than 1 hour to explain all this because it's a lot of information. You know, if you want to talk about democracy, we know about democracy is the power of the people. But if you go there, you need to see that it's the power of the majority of the people, because not all the people agree with power, you know? In every society, you have people that say, okay, we don't want to do this, we don't want to do that. So in Cuba, We believe that we have a democracy. The problem is that it's not a representative democracy because we don't believe in that. So you don't need to be a member of the Communist Party to be part of our government. You don't need to be a member of the Communist Party to go to our national parliament. You only need to be elected as a member of the parliament for the people that is in your district, you know? So it's not a matter that you are a member of the Communist Party. But the other issue is about dictatorship, about all the things that they say. We have 11 million inhabitants right now. And we have a national parliament that had 612 members in our National Assembly. So we have more representation if you go to the numbers. You know, 11 million, 600, because we grew up in our National Assembly at the same time that the population grew up, you know. So if we have more population, we have more members in our National Assembly. We have general elections every 5 years to change the National Assembly. And the National Assembly at least have to have 50% of their members needs to be elected from people in your neighborhood. You know, you need to be first a representative of your neighborhood in order to be elected in our National Assembly. And again, you need to have 50+1% of the vote, but that vote is a very low vote because what we have right now is is members with, I don't know, 90% of the support in our elections. And we have these municipal elections every 2.5 years. So the general elections is every 5 years. And the other thing is you don't have to spend money in a campaign, because if you are a person that your people wants to have as a candidate, the National Commission have to put the same resources on you and on in all the candidates. So you have the same opportunities that all the candidates. You know, it's not about your money. It's not about the people that support you. It's about that everybody has the same opportunity. So the biographies of all the candidates are in your neighborhood. It's only one page. Imagine that. The biography of our president and near to him, a biography of one student. One page for both, in black and white, because we don't have resources to put in color. So the same biography for our president, the same biography for a person that have been a minister, for example, and the same biography for one student, one worker, one woman that is a very well-known sport woman. So it's how that system works. You know, it's not mandatory to vote. It's not mandatory to vote. But the idea that we have more than 90% of people that vote is a proof that people support the system. Because if you don't have to vote and you go to vote, it's because you care about that. You know, so our constitution is from 1976 and was a constitution that was approved in the referendum. You know, popular referendum. We made reform in 1992. And after that, in 2002, we made another reform, and we made another kind of referendum, trying to prove that we have the support of the people. So it's a different system. We don't believe that you need money to be elected. We don't believe that this is a matter of parties. Our party, the Communist Party in Cuba, is not part of the electoral process. You know, and this is very important for us. You don't need to be a member of the Communist Party to go to all the positions in the government in Cuba.
It's interesting hearing you talk about constitutions and these referendums that change the national government in Cuba. So in a place like, you know, the United States, we treat our first draft of the Constitution as if it's like holy. It's like barely ever touched. It doesn't change with the times. But speaking on that topic, the United States has had some undue influence on the constitutional process in Cuba, especially in the first half of the 20th century. And I wondered if you could speak a little bit about an issue that's come back in the news here in the States, and I think is probably always an issue in Cuba, which is the Guantanamo Bay lease. That is how the United States got access to that land, how they keep that access to that land, and what it means.
We need to go back to 1898 when the Spanish-American War. And this is very interesting for a Cuban, you know, because in Cuba we don't call it American-Spanish War. We call it American-Cuban-Spanish War, you know. And probably the real is that it's Spanish, Puerto Rican, Cuban, Philippines, American War. So it's because everybody was there, you know. But after that, only United States and Spain went to Paris to sign the treaty. And after that, United States occupied Cuba. And the occupation started in January 1st, 1899. And when the first Cubans were trying to wrote a constitution, our first constitution was writing under an American occupation. And the governor of the island at that time called the people that was writing the constitution and said to him, okay, if you want a republic, you need to adopt the constitution with this document that comes from the Senate in the United States. It's the Platt Amendment. And according to that Platt Amendment, you have full control of Cuba. And you have the opportunities to sign all the treatment that you want between our two countries. And we only have to say, yes, we only need to sign this. So it was a split decision, but the majority of people support, okay, let's have a republic, and after that, we can deal with the Platt Amendment. Unfortunately, after that, we have this agreement in 1934 that was signed between Cuba and the United States in order to put an end to the Platt Amendment. But in that agreement in 1934, you get Guantanamo forever. And right now it's a lease. You control, you have all the control of the base, but it's our land. According either to those treaties, it's our land. But you have the control forever unless you say, okay, I don't want to be there in Guantanamo. And this is very important, and people don't know, because people heard what President Obama is saying right now. And President Obama is only saying that he's going to close the prison. He's not talking about the base. Mm-hmm. He's not talking about that. And people that talk with us say, we don't need that base. Probably in the 19th century, in the 20th century, we need that, you know. But right now, it's not as a strategic base. And again, we want that. Probably you know now how much do you pay for the base. This is not about money, but you pay $4,000 per year, $4,085 per year for a lot of land, you know. So it's not a fair treatment in any sense, and we want that territory back.
Why is it you think that the United States wants to hang on to Guantanamo Bay?
I don't know. Probably that is part of the Cold War idea. The Cold War moment when after the revolution you had this base there and you want to be there in order to be sure that you have control. And again, in the 19th century, in the 20th century, that was a strategic position. But right now, 90 miles away from Cuba, you don't need that base anymore. And as a matter of fact, according to the BBC, it's costing you a lot of money, you know, to run that base every year. Not in the lease, but just all the money that you have to pay for the base in order to sustain the base.
Oh yeah, yeah, our defense spending for sure. Are you hopeful that this attempt at changing the relations between Cuba and the United States could result in a robust discussion about returning this land to the people of Cuba?
Well, let me say this, because people is asking about what is happening right now. People are under the impression that everything is going wonderful between Cuba and the United States. We restored the diplomatic relations, and what December the 17th, 2014 proved is that you only need will. You know, if you are ready, if you have the will, we can discuss all our difference with respect as states, you know, that we are. With all the respect, we can discuss all our difference, and that start on December 17, 2014. But the real issue is that the embargo is there. Guantanamo is there, and those are concerns that we have. We need to put an end to the embargo. The embargo is hurting our people, and as a matter of fact, it's the main obstacle to our economic development, and it's the main obstacle to have normal relations, economic relations between Cuba and the United States. It's the same with Guantanamo. It's our territory. So in order to have normal relations, we need to see the end of the embargo. We need to see that Guantanamo is back to Cuba. And so those are our priorities.
The embargo impacts you in a lot of ways. And certainly one way was that's one of the reasons you only have 30 computers at the university for the law school. There's no cable from, it could be easy to have a cable hooked to the internet from the U.S., and that's been banned. And so I think Venezuela was going to help with one at one point. I don't know if that happened, but those kinds of barriers seem to have been extremely important. Plus, Cuba imports a good deal of food. Talk about that. What impact would that have here in the U.S. if they could buy food directly?
Well, about this specific, I can tell you that we buy, according to the United Nations, we buy between 70-80% of our food abroad. We are talking about $2 billion every year. Unfortunately, by law, it's prohibited to give credit to Cuba in the agricultural sector. So in other sectors, it's okay. But in the agricultural sector, it's prohibited by law to concede credit to Cuba. And for that reason, it's more easy to us to buy things in other countries and not here in the United States. For that reason, last year, we only buy here $300 million. But we buy in other countries $1.8 billion. So you're losing money because your farmers want to sell products to Cuba, but we don't have credit here. Is not a good deal for us. But if we had the opportunity to have credit and the farmers wants to give credit to Cuba, we are going to buy more things here because we are neighbors. From the Mobile port is 36 hours to Cuba. Imagine that. So 1.5 days in order to have the products to Cuba. About what you mentioned before about the telecommunication sector, is the truth. We didn't have the opportunity before to have this connection with a cable, and all cables around Cuba, you know, all the cables that comes to the United States from the United States to Latin America surround Cuba, and we didn't have the opportunity to connect to those cables. Right now, for the first time, we have the cable, and right now, for the first time, we have Wi-Fi connection in public spot in Cuba, because we don't have the technology, we don't have the infrastructure to put internet in our house. It's too expensive, and we don't want to create difference, because probably some people can pay for that, but the idea is to put access to all people possible. So if we put this Wi-Fi spot in all the province, in public space, so you can go with your smartphone, and you are going to see a lot of people connected to internet. Some of them only to see Facebook, only to see, you know, the news. But it's interesting. And right now it's expensive. I have to say that. It's expensive for the Cuban population. But the real issue is that people have access. You know, it's nothing restricted. That sometimes you hear, you read that in the media. The Cuban government don't want to allow access to the Cuban. That is not true.
You brought up the idea of media, and certainly one of the mythologies about Cuba that's perpetrated in the U.S. corporate media is that it's all tightly controlled, that it's top down, it's propaganda. And you have some 50 community radio stations that are run locally, let alone independence in terms of media. You have access to the global media. Yet, the U.S. won't let Cuban reporters into the United States. So this has been a very hypocritical statement around that. But talk about the freedom of the media and the press.
You know, the most important thing that you have right now is that we are in the 21st century. So everybody can have access to internet. It's a media person, you know, because you have your Twitter accounts, you have your Facebook page, and you can publish whatever you want. And that is happening in Cuba right now. You have people that has blogs, and you can read those blogs on the internet, and you are going to see what the people believe about all these things. And also we have this community media. The main idea is to try to produce the news of that community base, you know? And so it's something that is very funny when you say, okay, you don't have freedom of press in Cuba, and everybody can see CNN, you know, on the internet, can read all the newspapers. And the real issue is sometimes that people understand that what they say is not true. You know, it's not the real Cuba. And sometimes say, okay, why they don't come and do real work?
Exactly. And they, of course, can see Telesur and other sources from all over the world, which makes it pretty wide open. So Obama's going to visit Cuba on March 21st.
Yes.
What impacts will that have? What are you really anticipating there?
Well, as you probably remember, the other day at university, I mentioned that the last president that visited Cuba was in 1928. So I always ask, is somebody here from that moment, from that year? I only found one woman, by the way, that was born in 1926, so she can't remember, but in any case, she was alive. But this is interesting. You know, what we said is President Obama is welcome in Cuba. We are going to treat President Obama with all the respect and consideration of the position that he has. He is the President of the United States. And so he's welcome in Cuba. And this is another proof that the only thing that you need is will. You know, because you can read in some president's memoirs, okay, I was ready to improve the relations, I want to have this, I want to that, but this is the real person that start with a clear position. And I like very much what President Obama said in the last speech of the Union this year in January. He clearly said, the Cold War is over, lift the embargo. So that is what he wants. And this is very important because people don't understand wants the embargo, but the real issue is that all polls shows that the majority of Americans don't want the embargo. The majority of the Cuban-American population don't want the embargo. It's what the United Nations General Assembly has been asking for the last 24 years. And last year, we had 191 countries that asked to the United States, okay, you have to lift the embargo. So it's what your president wants. So why the embargo is still there?
I'm Nolan Higdon, and I'm in studio with Peter Phillips, and we are having a fascinating conversation with Miguel Fraga, the first secretary of the Embassy of Cuba in the United States, and we will return after this short break.
Back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips in studio with Nolan Higdon today. We're interviewing Miguel Fraga, who's the first secretary of the Cuban Embassy in Washington, D.C., and we're talking about the impacts of reestablishing diplomatic relations with the U.S. and Cuba. And, Miguel, I'd like you to do a little history here. I mean, certainly for the first few decades of the revolution, after the revolution, the Soviet Union was very supportive. The Cuban Missile Crisis almost brought us to nuclear war. It was a terribly dangerous time. After the Soviet Union disintegrates and there's no longer that kind of intense support for Cuba, there was a real push inside of Cuba that had to be some transformations. And there was the impact in terms of organic agriculture was really huge. I mean, you're now the number one country in terms of organic agriculture in the world. What was that period like? Can you describe that?
Well, let me start saying that, remember, 1959, we had to change everything because everything was made in USA. And in 1991, we have to change everything again because everything was made in the Soviet Union or the countries in the communist bloc. So we start over twice in 40 years. And this was an amazing experience, a very hard moment. I want to say this because I mention this all the time I have the opportunity. At the beginning of the revolution, people say, okay, this is only 6 months. After 6 months, they're going to collapse. After that, they say, okay, it's because the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union is there. Well, the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, and we are still there. People say after that, okay, the problem is Fidel. Fidel is there after Fidel. Well, Fidel is no longer in power since 2006, so 10 years ago. Now people say, oh, the problem is Raul. I don't know why they're going to say after 2018, because it's people that don't want to recognize that it's a process that have the support of the majority of the Cuban people. So about agriculture, imagine when we lost 80% of our trade overnight because the Soviet Union collapsed. We lost all our credit. We lost all our supplies. We had blackouts. 8 hours per day. We didn't have transportation, we didn't have oil, we didn't have anything. And you say, how did you survive? Well, because that was what the Cuban population wants, you know, and we start working with our hands as the people at the beginning of the humanity, you know, we start working in our land, we start producing our own food. And of course, because we didn't have pesticides, we didn't have oil and machinery, was a very healthy food, and that is what we want, because in order to have healthy people, you need healthy food. And now, as I mentioned before, we buy 70-80% of our food, so we don't produce enough. And this is not because we don't have land, this is not because we don't want to produce more food. The problem is that after you go to the university and you are an engineer, a doctor, a lawyer, whatever, you don't want to go back to work in the land, so that, because it's hard work. You know, and you say, okay, I'm a professional. So that is another problem that we have. But the real issue is that many people start producing their own food in a very organic system. And we have people that in his jar produce vegetables with only water and land, you know. So that is how we are trying to be sustainable, you know, but because that is another challenge that we have right now. And people ask me, do you want clean energy? Yes, we want clean energy, but it's expensive and we don't have the resources. But that is our goal too, you know. And so we are trying to have the right priorities with our limited resources.
But your health care is part of the GDP. I mean, you make money off of health care worldwide, have some of the best eye care in the world. That's certainly one thing that Cuba's known for. And Michael Moore's movie, of course, was bringing people from 9/11 there for x-rays and care, what they weren't able to get in the United States.
Yes, but remember about this that you mentioned. It's true that we, for example, in tourism, we receive 3 million of tourists every year, 1 million come from Canada, and we are getting some resources. But the issue is that the embargo is so a real issue that we say, and according to the some treaties, it's a genocide. You know, it's an economic war. You are trying to create desperation with this policy, because I'm going to put you one example about this. What is the embargo? Remember that you have this law from 1992, the Torricelli Act, that say that it's a ship that's in Cuba needs to wait 180 days to come to the United States. So imagine every time, and we are an island, we need to bring things to us by ship. If we need a ship, we need to pay more for nothing. Because people say, remember, I cannot go to the United States in 180 days. We cannot use your American dollars as a currency to buy things. And sometimes when we have American dollars, we have to change our currency to another currency and we lost money. And there is a lot of examples. I can put you one example. 2 weeks ago, probably 3 weeks ago, there is this company here in the United States that made a business with a company in Angola. They sell some things to that company. In that company in Angola, Cuba has 20% of participation. 20% of participation. And this company in the United States was fined by the Treasury Department. A huge fine. So now nobody wants to do business with us. For example, right now, it's too difficult, or sometimes more expensive. Right now, it's possible to open office from American banks in Cuba, but we don't have any banks in Cuba from the United States. Why? Because everybody's waiting. What is going to happen? You know, we need to change the laws first.
So the embargo has serious economic impacts. It's really left over from the Cold War. There's vested interests inside the United States to maintain it. as almost punishment for Cuba under a justification that it's a communist dictatorship, which simply isn't true.
And you have wonderful relations with communist countries, you know. You have wonderful trade relations, so there's no real excuse, you know, to have the embargo in place. The real issue is that the embargo is for another moment in history and it's not working to overthrow the government. The Cuban people support the government, and in that case, you see that is not a real policy. That is a failed policy. President Obama explained that in his last speech of the Union address. So the real issue is that the embargo is still in place. The embargo is the main obstacle for our development and also for better relations between Cuba and the United States.
Yeah, I was thinking that when you were saying that, I was thinking that even if the horrible myths about Cuba that have been perpetrated here in the United States for the last 60 years were true, we actually have normalized relationships with countries that actually do the atrocities that are claimed about Cuba. So yeah, it is sort of ironic they're the ones we cut off conversation with. I also kind of think it's funny, the high school mentality that we're just going to stop talking to. That's the way of dealing with international relations. So growing up in Cuba, you're born shortly after this constitutional transformation, and you come in your teen years during the fall of the Soviets and another transformation of economic policy. What is it that drove you to get into politics and international relations? Why choose this field? What was it about this? What drove you to do that?
Well, interesting question. It's always difficult to speak about myself, no, because it's not what I do. But the idea is that I am a son of a farmer. My father born in 1939, difficult moment, and he started working when he was 10 years old in 1949. So the dream of my father was that his sons can go to the university because he was unable to go. So he put all his efforts to try to say, okay, you need to be somebody, you need to go to the university. And I studied law because I love laws. You need to understand how the system works. So, and after that, I have this opportunity because of my grades. They say, okay, you can go to the Diplomatic Academy in Havana. You want to go? And I say, what are my opportunities there? And they say, okay, you can study a master degree in foreign relations. I say, okay, wonderful. And after that, they say, okay, if you want, you can start working in North America division, attending U.S. And I say, okay, that is what I want, because this is our main challenge, you know. And for that reason, I am here, because I really believe that we can have normal relations with respect, and it's good for both sides. And if we can see the end of the embargo, if we can put an end to that, that is going to help my people. So for that reason, I am proud to be Cuban. So many times I go to many places and people say, thanks to Cuba for all his example in education, healthcare, all the help that you have been doing in Africa and Latin America. And I say, okay, thank you very much. I took that, but I was not part of that, you know. It's my father's generation, you know, my people. So I am proud to be a Cuban, to represent my people. But it's interesting how we have support, love from many people here in the United States and all around the world.
I was going to ask you about that. So you're coming into the United States, and just on this tour alone, you've had a chance to talk to many Americans. And as we kind of discussed earlier, the Americans do not know a lot about Cuba nor the history of the United States and Cuba. So I was wondering, what sort of response are you getting from people when you tell your story about Cuba and what you've seen there growing up in Cuba? How is people responding to that here in the States?
Well, I try to present all this information. Probably the professor can say what was his experience, but I try to present all of this information according to American sources or international sources, and people is completely, okay, I didn't know that. How is that possible? Why we don't have normal relations? Why I cannot travel to Cuba? So you see that what all the polls shows, that is support, is real. It's people that is there and say, why not? Why we don't have normal relations between Cuba and United States? So it's very good to see that. To see that people comes with a lot of histories. My fathers were married in Cuba. My father had their honeymoon in Cuba, or my grandfather, depending on the generation that is there. And people say, okay, I was in Alabama, by the way. I was in Alabama, and somebody told me that Cubans learned to play baseball in Alabama. Two Cuban brothers in the 19th century were in Alabama in a school in Spring Hill College, and they learned how to play baseball, and they bring back baseball to Cuba, and now baseball is our national sport. So you see, we have a lot of history together, and the real issue is that the most important is we have the support, the real support of the people in both sides, because people know that it's possible to have normal relations and it's good for the for both sides. And what you mentioned about the embargo, I'm going to say, how can you understand, how can you explain that we have 191 countries that say to the United States, lift the embargo? It's not a bilateral issue anymore. And the other 190 countries, the 190 that support Cuba in this battle, is because they are suffering the embargo also. You know, it's difficult to do business with Cuba because of the embargo.
Who would you say are some of Cuba's most important partners for things like trade and culture?
Well, according to the numbers that I have from the World Bank in 2013, our key trading partners are Venezuela, Canada, China, the Netherlands, Brazil, and Spain. Imports and exports.
I was reading a survey that said over 56% of the Cuban Americans, people of Cuban ancestry living in the United States, now support normalization of relationships. So there isn't this hardcore, I mean, there certainly is a hardcore right wing, and certainly a number of them in the Congress right now who block normalization and want to even try to reverse it. But the Council of Foreign Relations 5 years ago was making recommendations for opening trade agreements and better, because it makes economic sense for the United States. The United States would make money, it would create jobs, it would expand the capabilities to have, you know, trading with the 11 million people in Cuba and have that kind of open access. And it certainly would improve the lives and benefit people. And imagine, I mean, that you have Canadians. I mean, everybody I know wants to go to Cuba now that they, oh, I can go now. You know, that's not illegal anymore. And I had a good friend who went down and came back and was fined for going there. So opening that up would be a tremendous benefit for both countries, I would think.
Oh, yes, for sure. And remember, because it's again the same question, people believe that, okay, you're going to change. No, we are doing business with all the countries in the world. So right now, probably we have more opportunities between Cuba and United States. But you are going to open hotels there, and we have hotels from Spain, we have hotels from Germany, we have hotels from all the countries. So you're not going to be the first. Unfortunately, probably you're going to be the last people that goes to Cuba. But in any case, this is the most important. It's good. You don't have any excuse to say, okay, we cannot have normal relations between Cuba and United States.
We're in an interview today with Miguel Farga, First Secretary of the Embassy of Cuba in the U.S. And I would like to ask, Miguel, recently Pope Francis visited Cuba and had huge crowds, and certainly it speaks to the importance of the Vatican and freedom of religion in Cuba. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yes, Pope Francis was welcome in Cuba. And as you probably remember, Pope John Paul II and also Pope Benedict visit Cuba. So that speak about our freedom of religion in Cuba right now, and for many years it's easy to practice your religion in Cuba. Pope Francis was very important in this new approach between Cuba and United States. He wrote letters to President Raul and President Obama trying to help him put in contact President Obama and President Raul, and trying to say, okay, why you don't start working for good relations. So in Cuba, it's a society with equal opportunities for all the people. It's not a matter of religion. You know, you can profess all the religion that you want.
Well, the Pope has certainly been very strong, even in his visit to Mexico, talking about inequality and really describing great wealth almost as sinful. So I think that's certainly a step in a correct direction, and certainly compatible with the revolutionary ideas that are emerging and have over 50 years now been in Cuba. So as the leadership ages, and the assembly obviously is going to select a new president within a couple years, you're part of a generation of Cubans who grew up inside of the Cuban revolution and the communist belief, and you're part of that generation. What do you see for the future?
Well, I see that we have, as I explained before, a lot of challenge. The new leadership is not going to have the same authority that Fidel and Raul had because they were part of the generation that made the revolution. But I believe that we have right now people that is ready to lead the country with the right priorities. Because, again, it's not a matter of the person that is going to be there in 2 years as a new president. It's a matter that what are the priorities that the majority of the people support. And the leadership of Fidel and Raul, their history, they are going to be there, you know, because it's the generation that had the opportunity to know what is real leadership, what is real government that cares about the priorities, the needs that the people have. So it's a challenge, but I believe that we need to face that challenge, and we are going to succeed as long as we have the opportunity to keep the priorities that we have right now and improve the economic situation.
We have just a few minutes left in the show, but how can people support normalization of relations with Cuba and really try to get past this Cold War mentality?
Well, I think it's very important that people know that right now we need Congress to do the real change in this. And I believe that people need to know that there are very good bills that in Congress, for example, the S-299, Freedom to Travel to Cuba. We have 47 senators that support that bill, so we are talking about 47% of the Senate, but we don't have the same support in the House. And probably what people need to know is, because sometimes people say, okay, the people in the Hill said, okay, I don't hear nothing from my district, you know? Well, if you believe that this is something that you want, that is something that you can do, you know? And also, try to find more information, more real information about Cuba. That is what I encourage the people to do. My invitation is, if you don't believe me, go to Cuba. Go to Cuba and see what is the real Cuba. I want to say thanks to you for this opportunity. I really appreciate that. I want to say hello to all the people that is listening right now. Sorry for my English. Probably need to improve more, but this is a good opportunity to practice.
Well, you've been doing a very good job. Certainly, thank you. And you're in Washington. I assume you're very active in engaging in these agendas there, and we thank you very much for your support.
Thanks to you.
And coming on our show with us. Nolan, you had to wrap up?
I just want to say thanks for coming on the show. We appreciate having you.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Gary Bach is our engineer. Anthony Fest is our producer. We welcome our new affiliate stations, KVWR in Billingham, Washington, and WWUH in West Hartford, Connecticut. That's 32 stations now airing the show across the U.S. Archives can be found on theprojectcensored.org. Please follow us and like us on Facebook. Thank you very much. It's a dirty game, maintain my reign for capital gain. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. When our commodities or cars that turn the global economy, where the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won. We got the love of just our brothers and our sisters.
By the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, skies, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, hypnotized by the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that.